The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly guest Dharma series.
Welcome everyone who came out on this dulcet April day where we are really enjoying the prime of a Minnesota spring. Thank you all for coming. It is my great pleasure to introduce my dear Dharma sister and good friend, Ayoung Tunmi, who will then introduce Professor Bidwell. And Ayo is the assistant professor of pastoral and spiritual care and counseling and director of United's interreligious chaplaincy program. And she is the author of Object Relations, Buddhism and Relationality in Womanist Practical Theology. I'm going to read that again because it's such an unusual and gripping and amazing title. It's called Object Relations, Buddhism and Relationality in Womanist Practical Theology. And she has a book on Buddhist-Christian dialogue, religious freedom law, and transgender spiritual care that will be published this year. Ayo led United's incredibly well-received Theology of Prince project that was at the University of Minnesota, and she's researched the spirituality in Prince's music and in Audre Lorde's poetry. Her articles appear in Buddha Dharma, Lion's Roar, Journal of Buddhist Christian Studies, Religions, and Feminist Theology. She's an interfaith Buddhist practitioner, and I am so happy that she is my dear friend, and she's actually my supervisor at United Theological, so thank you for coming.
Patrice is the best. I moved here a year and a half ago. Now I'm going to introduce you. I moved here a year and a half ago, and Patrice gave me this beautiful Chinese calligraphy as a way of welcoming me. And then we began to talk, and I'm making this real short just to say I was so impressed by Patrice's compassion, her intelligence, and her knowledge of the Dharma. Beautiful, and I received it and have received you as a friend, and thank you very much, Patrice. Thank you.
So who is supervising whom?
Okay. Isn't that the question?
Right.
I'd like to introduce to you all, first, thank you all for coming during the week at 4 o'clock. We were wondering if we meet anybody today, and so we're so glad that you all are here. I'd like to introduce to you one of my colleagues, Dr. Dwayne Bidwell. Not colleague in terms of working together in Minnesota, but we are both members of the Society for Buddhist Christian Studies, also the Society for Pastoral Theology. And I met Dr. Bidwell. Are you going by Dwayne today? Okay, Dr. Dwayne Bidwell, it's up to you. I met Dwayne at the Society of Pastoral Theology. I don't know if you remember, but it was the first time I was at this meeting and I didn't know anyone. I'm kind of shy and new settings. And so I saw an empty chair at a table. And the reason why I chose that chair is because there was a bag. On that bag, there was the HRC sticker. And, you know, the equality sticker. And I thought, well, as a gay person, this would probably be a safe person for me to sit next to. And it was Dr. Dwayne. Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Several years ago.
She didn't know that no one else would sit next to me.
Right. And I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Dr. Bidwell, Dwayne, teaches at the Claremont School of Theology, currently in Claremont, California. And I did not memorize your exact title.
It's okay.
But I'm going to read it to you. It's on the back of his book. By the way, this book is excellent. And I'm not saying that just because I appreciate who he is, but because I've read it, I wrote a review on it, it's excellent. Dr. Bidwell is professor of practical theology, spiritual care, and counseling at Claremont School of Theology, a clinical fellow of the American Association of Pastoral Counselors, which is now ACPE, mm-hmm. right? Which is Associate of Clinical Pastoral Education. Okay, he has been a chaplain, pastor, counselor, and nonprofit director. Currently, Duane sits on the board of the Taos Institute and maintains a small clinical practice at the Kleinbell Institute for Pastoral Counseling in Claremont. Both Buddhist, as in Insight Theravada Buddhist, and Christian, as in Presbyterian, Duane lives in California with his wife, son, and dog.
You just reminded me that my wife says my epitaph will read, "He looked good on paper."
I will lastly, I'll say that Duane is the author of several books. His most recent book, When One Religion Isn't Enough, The Lives of Spiritually Fluid People. So thank you so much for coming here. And we don't really know how this is going to work, but we'll see.
Right. You're going to start, right?
Oh, okay. I just did.
Yeah. Okay. I thought you were going to ask some questions.
Okay. How many people here consider themselves to be spiritually fluid people?
I was raised Catholic, and I never really had a...
So thank you for helping me get to know you a little bit, because that will help me kind of shape what we do here. And what we talked about was that I would read a little bit, and Io would ask questions, and we would do that for a little while, and then we would have Q&A. Is that what we talked about?
Yes.
Okay. Talking about the number of Catholic Buddhists in the room reminded me of being at a conference once where, do you all know Ruben Abito? Mm-hmm. He's the director of the Maria Cannon Zen Center in Dallas, and he's a former Jesuit priest lineage holder in a Zen lineage. And he spoke at a conference, and I was in a small group with a woman who self-identified as Catholic. And when he was done speaking, she leaned over and she said, "I just don't get how you could be Buddhist and Catholic." And I said, "Oh, I identify as Christian and Buddhist." And she said, "Well, what do you do with Jesus?" And I said, I don't do anything with Jesus. Jesus does things with me. And then she didn't speak to me the rest of the afternoon. So I feel some of that, the guilt and the othering from other people who don't understand how we can bring traditions together, or who perceive it as something that is at best just transgressive and at worst, right, sinful or harmful and those kinds of things, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book, because theologians, primarily Christian theologians, have written a lot about what they call multiple religious belonging. But what they've done is they've tried to evaluate or norm the experience. And primarily they ask, is it possible? And if it's possible, is it right? And they've done that without understanding it as a human experience. And because of my training, our training, we would say you have to start with experience and understand that before you can ever have a normative conversation. So that the question isn't, is it possible? We know it's possible, right? We see people who do it. We talk to them. They publish things. They teach. We interact with them all the time. And the question isn't, is it right? The question is, what is it like to live a spiritually fluid life? How do people bring traditions together that other people might see as being in conflict or... as at best contradicting each other in generative ways, and at worst being so chaotic, the person must not be mentally stable, right? And I hear that a lot, actually, in my setting. I don't know if you do that. People who are part of more than one tradition, they can't be stable. And I sometimes say, well, that's a great thing. The illusion of stability isn't that helpful, right? That doesn't go very far. So I didn't decide ahead of time what parts of the book to read, because I wanted to get here and find out who you are first. So let me read just a little bit from the introduction and page 3, which is the subtitle is Where I Stand, and it is the sentence is right before it says, it seems important to clarify a few of my beliefs. I am Buddhist and Christian. Jesus is my savior, and the Buddha is my teacher. Jesus restores me over and over again. He gives life. He heals, although not usually all at once, and sometimes that healing can be painful. Jesus asks me to be honest with him, to be present to him, and to agree to measure my life against his. For me, Jesus is divinity con carne, holiness with meaty ribs, an ultimate reality that breathes and sweats and feels. He enables me to see and hear and feel and understand mystery with a capital M, by which I mean the ultimate sources, identities, meanings, and truths that orient human lives and give them meaning. I am Christian primarily by God's action and invitation. I affirmed that identity through baptism, but I did not request or choose it. God acted first. But it's hard for me to follow Jesus. I need a schematic, a rational step-by-step guide to waking up to mystery, and Jesus doesn't provide that. The Christian Bible, after all, isn't a user's manual or a book of rules. It's a collection of vignettes, a gathering of voices. Attempting to live like Jesus requires art, not science. He teaches with metaphors and parables, not flowcharts. Jesus just doesn't provide a well-marked trail you can follow directly to your final destination. This is where the Buddha comes in. His teaching is coherent. He provides a precise 8-step path toward awakening and an overarching account of reality, or metaphysic, that fits a Western scientific worldview. The philosopher Alfred North Whitehead once said, somewhat too neatly, I think, that Buddhism is a metaphysic in search of a religion, while Christianity is a religion in search of a metaphysic. I am Buddhist primarily by choice. Receiving nourishment from both traditions satisfies my longing for both a metaphysic and a religion. It gives me wise teaching and loving practices, a holy relationship, and a path to awakening. Sustenance I wouldn't have if I were only Christian or only Buddhist. Yet my connection to Buddhism isn't only pragmatic or instrumental. It claims me emotionally too. I am more apt to feel tearful or joyful when chanting at the temple than when I'm worshiping in church. Buddhism changes the way I know and experience God. It broadens and deepens my understanding and experience of Christianity. Likewise, Jesus helps me understand more fully why Buddha insisted that virtue, meditation, and wisdom must be linked. Jesus calls me to action in the world in ways the Buddha does not. I have a relationship with God. I have admiration for the Buddha. I don't need to justify my complex religious bonds. In fact, not needing to defend them is a fundamental right of spiritually fluid people.
Did y'all get that? You know, I was thinking a couple of things. One is I wouldn't get this at all if I hadn't had similar experiences, mm-hmm. One. Two, but I think you have an ability to articulate it in a way that I can't, and maybe not yet anyway, and maybe others struggle to if they don't know their traditions as well as you do. So I'm wondering about you being a seminary educated, doctoral level Presbyterian minister who has for years taught others about the Bible, about Jesus, and if that has a bearing on your ability to articulate where you are now? And if you don't have those things or those experiences, how might you go articulating where you are in your fluidity now?
So early on, when I was attempting to bring the traditions together, I read a book by Joko Beck at the San Diego Zen Center. And I called and asked for a telephone appointment with her to figure out what I was doing or whether this was possible. And what I remember of the conversation is that it was very short and that she just said, "Well, it sounds like you're doing what you need to do. Good luck." Which in retrospect was wise, but at the time didn't really give me what I was after, because there wasn't any kind of content to it or any kind of direction about what I was doing. And I didn't trust myself to be in charge of that. And my Buddhist teacher would say, "I don't know why you talk to those Christians. You still have so much to learn about Buddhism." And my Christian friends would say, "Well, it's cute that you hang out at the temple, but I'm glad you found Jesus." And I didn't have a way to respond to those things. And so I think, in part, my commitments in theological education and to teaching other people grow out of that experience of not having anybody who could help me get that, right? People were writing about it, but the people who write about it in academic journals that are behind a paywall. In those days, we didn't have the internet. Most people who are spiritually fluid, who are wrestling with questions like that, don't have access to what the scholars are saying. And what the scholars are saying probably isn't all that useful to them because it is very technical. And it tends to be textually based or historically based or anthropologically based, but it's not based in how spiritually fluid people experience the tensions, in large part. So that's one part of an answer. Another part of the answer is, because I went through the ordination process and the certification process as a pastoral counselor, I had to learn to articulate my identities to people who couldn't understand them. And I had to learn, painfully in some ways, that not everyone perceived multiplicity as a gift or saw it as a resource for caring for people. And to experience some of the pain and the drawbacks to identifying as multiple with people who expected singular identities. And to read the room about how much I could disclose or what language I should use in order to talk about that. And another reason then for the book is I want there to be a shared language that we have to talk about these experiences and to normalize them so that we can have conversation that's not threatening. Because we, meaning educated primarily white Americans, tend to think of spiritually fluid people as choosing to be fluid. And most of the scholarship on it emphasizes that agency, the choice of connecting to two traditions. But most spiritually fluid people in the world don't choose it. They inherit it from their family or from their culture, or they feel that they've been called into this collaborative way of being by mystery itself. They don't perceive it as choice. It is something they're responding to, something that's being asked of them. And they love it and experience it as joyful and full and life-giving, and they have learned not to talk to other people about that. So I wanted a book that helped those folks articulate what they were saying. And actually, one of the best feedback I can ever get from someone who's read the book is to say, "I never knew there were so many people like me," or "Thank you for helping me have words to talk to my family about what I'm doing." Because we don't have resources available to most people who are living in both traditions at once. They hide in their communities, They don't disclose, even though if you talk to them, their lives are really integrated and really rich. So that's a long answer. Okay.
I'm satisfied.
Ooh. With that answer. All right.
Would you like to read something else?
So much for dissatisfaction here. Sure.
Okay.
What I think I'll go to next is about identity. It's ironic, oh, page 77. And that won't be the same in the hardcover book because I have a pre-uncorrected page proof that I'm reading from because it weighs less in my luggage. It's ironic to write about being both Buddhist and Christian because the traditions toss out the idea that we can claim identity for ourselves. Identity for Christians comes from God through baptism, a sacrament involving prayer and water. And for Reformed Christians like me, baptism isn't a human choice, but a visible sign that God has claimed us and cleansed us. It's God's action, not ours. Buddhists reject identity altogether. The doctrine of no self, anatta, instead affirms that nothing, not people, not flowers, not animals, not houses, not nations, nothing has an inherent self or identity. Instead, everything is impermanent, impersonal, and if we try to hold on to it as something real, dissatisfying. For Buddhists, it's a delusion to believe the self exists, and we suffer if we insist that identity is stable or lasting. But this ephemeral state is not our experience. Day by day, our identities don't seem temporary, empty, or erased. They endure from year to year and decade to decade, chiseled into us by the world. They carry our values and wisdom and preferences and relationships. Identities define how we understand ourselves and how we are understood by others. They allow us to navigate the world successfully, relating to others and to reality. They're a tool for navigating life. Sometimes my identity seems so full it could overflow the way water spills over a stopped-up sink. We can't do without identities. We need them. If we need identities to be fully human and to live well with others, then how do we make sense of these religious truths? What would it mean to live as if identity doesn't really exist, and or that identity comes from somewhere beyond us? It's helpful, from my perspective, to see identity as a collection of meanings negotiated with others. My identity doesn't come from inside me, but emerges between me and others during shared experiences, like washing dishes, following traffic laws, honoring parents, celebrating birthdays, attending funerals, and coordinating our energy and skills to achieve goals and get work done. Who I am emerges from relationships first. Only later do I take into myself the meanings that form identity, where they become a resource or tool for navigating the world and meeting its goals. If this is true in any sense, if who I am emerges from what I do with the meanings I receive from others, then I am what I do in response to the world. That assertion makes identity something practiced or performed rather than something we are or believe. This way of understanding identity makes sense to me. Spiritual practices, for example, the things we do to stay connected with mystery or to reflect what is ultimately true, often reveal religious identity better than what we believe, or say we believe, or which religious institutions we belong to. The importance of religious and spiritual action rather than belief and belonging came to the forefront of the 2016 presidential campaign, when Donald Trump publicly identified as a Christian, and Pope Francis pointed to the candidate's words and actions as inherently not Christian. In light of how Trump performs his religious and spiritual identity in daily life, the Pope called that identity into question. So what does it look like to perform or practice religious identity when you have bonds to more than one tradition.
That was really loaded.
It was.
I mean, I've got all kinds of questions swirling in my mind. And I'm going to try to bring it down to the issue or question of giving yourself permission. I heard the word guilt earlier.
Yeah.
Right? In my experience of practicing Buddhism, there has not been the use and abuse of guilt and shame. But growing up in the United Methodist Church, a lot of that, which I think maybe gets lodged in our minds and it's hard to unlodge it. I have personally found loving kindness meditation to be a useful practice in dislodging guilt and shame. But I'm wondering about how you are able to give yourself permission to critique the things that you don't believe in, the things you have come to not believe in. How did you give yourself permission to do that? And how have you integrated, allowed yourself to integrate as you have these two traditions? And then I'll add to this, to all of that.
I thought you were simplifying
this. Oh, I was, right? And then proclaim it out loud.
Oh, okay. The phrase you used, Ayo, about giving permission, reminded me of Carlos Alejandro, who is one of the people I interviewed in the book. Carlos is a Christian Church Disciples of Christ pastor and an Ifa priest. And he is a chaplain who works with dying people. And one of the ways he described his struggle and eventually his embracing of two traditions was that he said, I realized I finally had to do what I do for patients, which is to say, at the end of your life, you should embrace all of the spiritual resources that mean something to you. Now is not a time to separate and divide. Now is a time to bring together and to live as if I might not be here tomorrow. And if that's the case, how do I want these traditions to dance in my life? Now, for him, that meant retaining Christian ordination and being initiated as a priest in Africa, right? This answer feels too facile to me, so I reserve the right to change it later. At some point, the pain of withholding permission becomes too hard to bear. And you just decide, well, fuck it, I'm going to do it, right? That there has to be something there if I feel this strongly about it. And I won't know what's there if I don't give myself permission to do it. Some things you can't know until you try. You can't think your way out of them. You can't know what they are or use it for good until it's become a part of your embodied self. And if you withhold permission from going into those scary places, you limit who you are. And part of what my Buddhist tradition would say, where loving kindness is so important, is that your task in the world is to reduce suffering. And if you are limiting the tools you have to reduce suffering, you're only creating more suffering. So that the responsible thing to do is to embrace those tools and to learn to use them responsibly. So I think that's a key, is being responsible. I knew, as I said before, I couldn't be my own guide. So I had to find people and communities that I would allow to hold me accountable in both communities, and people who were willing to say, all right, I don't get it, but let's see where it goes. Right? This is where good psychotherapists and spiritual directors come into play. There's a portion in the book where I talk about my first ordination interview, where I joyfully proclaimed my duality as a resource for ministry, and one of the committee members in particular shut that down very quickly by saying, do you know the part of the Bible that says, I am the way and the truth and the life, no one comes to the Father except for me? And when I tried to say, yes, here's how I interpret that, his response was, there is no interpretation. I have seen your first leaf, and I know what you are. So Buddhist Christian studies became an academic interest. Yeah? That as a scholar, I could enter critically into these things or reflect on them and write about them without having to disclose identity and without having to own the source of gifts or insight, really. And I got tired of doing that. Now, having tenure and being at a school, an interreligious school like Claremont, makes that easier in some ways. But I decided, I told Io earlier, this is the first book I've really written for myself, right? Instead of for gatekeepers. And people tried to make the book something it isn't, right? Every publisher had their idea of what book this should be. And I was expected to go along with that or not get a contract, which, so no contract. I wanted a voice where other spiritually fluid people could hear someone speaking that they recognized, so that they might be a little less alone in the world, and they might feel like they're a little more legitimate than the culture tends to tell them. And I have the privilege of doing that because the risks are pretty low for me. That said, I always tell my wife, you know, I'm just waiting to be brought up on charges in the church, and what great PR that would be, right? Think how many books we'll sell. But that hasn't happened either. It's probably time for Q&A.
It's time for Q&A.
I don't think this is a question, but I'm just, if I didn't know where I was sitting, you could be talking about gender identification. I mean, everything you said.
Yeah, isn't that curious?
And so what can we learn from that? I mean, just as I'm beginning to become conscious of the pain and the struggle and the suffering around the silencing and the isolation, makes me want to weep. Of people who are not, who don't, you know, identify with the traditional two categories. I mean, this is a conversation we need to be having and forcing on our religious communities, because the structures have not developed to accommodate that. That's very scary. So, just a comment. I'm not sure it's a question.
No, but I could say something in response to it, which is a part of the genealogy of the book that I haven't talked about a lot. A long time ago, Jaretta Marshall, who is another spiritual care scholar, and I had a project called Beyond Apologetics, Sexual Identity, Pastoral Theology, and Pastoral Practice. And we brought together a consortium of queer pastoral theologians and said, if you didn't have to do apologetics for the inclusion of queer people in the church every time you sat down to write something, what would you write about? What does queer theology and queer theory offer to the broader community that's not about, here's why you should accept people? And that 18-month process, I think, was part of the genesis of this book, because a part of what queer theory offers us are ways of talking about these things that we haven't had before. So when you say, we could be talking about gender theory, well, yeah, I'm channeling Ricky Wilchins in some ways, right? And channeling scholarship on sexual identity that says you move through stages of attraction, behavior, and identity. And it's the same way with religious identity. We're attracted to things, we practice them, and maybe we come to identify, but maybe we don't, right? So I'm with you that the experiences are similar. They're not exactly the same. A group of students at Union, not Union Twin Cities, Union New York City. Oh, sorry, yes, United. Called me to task for using the metaphor of coming out because they wanted to say that it is not as risky to come out as religiously multiple as it is to come out as queer. And my response to that was, in some contexts, that's true. But in other contexts, it's more dangerous to come out as religiously multiple than it is to come out as queer.
It's harder for me
too. In what way?
Well, because we've already started the dialogue.
We've already started the dialogue about, you know, gender, queer, whatever, because I know someone who is. Well, you might not know that you know. You're like, you know, we're not talking about it. We're in the closet, and I'm gay, and I'm going to use that phrase. I am in the closet where I'm supposed to pray, as I've been instructed to go to my closet and pray, right? You know, I always say I'm not in the closet. I'm out in the living room with my feet up on the table. Well, I'd like to put my feet on the other table too.
The religious table.
That's right. But I'm scared. It's scary. I mean, this is what I'm going to be doing for my life, you know. I have been doing it for 20 years. And I had to answer a question about, oh, so it's kind of like goulash, right? And I'm like, ooh.
That's good old melting pot metaphor.
Yeah,
we all learned
it just sounds like the dish at the end of a Minnesota hot dish table that nobody's touching, or that you can't tell what the ingredients are until somebody eats it, and then you go, oh, that sounds good to me. But I said it's more like stone soup.
It takes on the flavor of whatever you
is put in the pot with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
The person behind you has his hand up.
So I'll go really quickly here. I'm guessing that you've read or know of the book, What Makes You Not a Buddhist?
I know of it, but I have not read it.
And to me, my mom was Catholic. She had to become a Lutheran to marry my dad back in the day. That was like a mixed marriage that wasn't going to happen. And I have a military background where I'm used to a chaplain having to be able to deal with whatever comes up in front of typically him, but I don't know if I ever met any women chaplains in the military, but we have them. And so I'm used to that fit whatever happens, but when I read the book, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, I really locked in onto those things and the difference between following a set of rules as opposed to taking the pieces of philosophy that work. And when I listen to you, and I'm definitely going to buy your book because I am one of those people that for a long time described myself as in lowercase Buddhist Christian, putting in alphabetically that order, not because one is more important than the other, but when I look at the rules of each of those two religions, it's virtually impossible to combine them in a rule-based fashion.
Yes.
But the philosophies, the do unto others, the loving kindness, that all melts together. And so for me, it sort of depends on what am I going to hang on to the moment before I die, if I'm able to be awake enough to hang on to anything. Because all the rest of it is just combining the good of each religion. And kind of like the woman over here, I don't know if this is so much a question or a statement, but it's like, where do we go if we want to fit with each other and do well and do good and ease suffering? But each of these microcosm religions has special rules, and I highly recommend that book. I think you'd find it fascinating. So,
Thank you.
What Makes You Not a Buddhist?
Do you know the author? You knew somebody was going to ask.
I've got it in my phone, and I'll look it up for you. So okay. There's a short version of it in, I think, Tricycle, where it's like a synopsis of the article, and then there's the actual book. So, and his book is about the same size as yours.
Okay.
So I have one of these niggling academic, something that for me was a stopper in your book. And it was that you, and I have to apologize, I have a my background is philosophy, and I came to this with having read Nittner's book.
Who's?
Paul Nittner.
Yeah.
And found this was the problem that I encountered with Nittner's book, is that you take Paticca Samuppada, the idea of dependent co-arising, and Thich Nhat Hanh then skillfully melds that into interbeing, and suddenly that moves into mystery, and that's where God is.
Right.
And for me, the description of codependent arising is simply when this happens, that happens. When this arises, that arises. When that it is simply a description. And Thich Nhat Hanh does a little something more with it, which is, I think, to infuse the poetry that we see ourselves in the clouds and the rain and the trees, so that we have that sort of. But suddenly, when it all becomes mystery, capital M, I think that's not what this is. I mean, it's mystery in the sense of kind of wow, but not mystery
with
in the theological
M.
sense with a capital M.
Yeah.
And that for me is just a huge stopper. It's kind of a transmutation of a doctrine that was simply, folks, this is the basic description of how the world is. And so if you could say something to that, I would appreciate it.
How much time? No.
She's,
yeah, you she didn't say you're like that.
Yeah,
anyway, A, you didn't need to apologize.
Well, thank you.
Or say thank you. What's that?
Ways that we interact energetically with the world around us, and it helps kind of come up with a higher level view that you can synchronize Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, you know, all kind of together.
Which is part of what Paul Nittner does. So, and Paul lives here now. He's retired and in Minnesota, I think, Minneapolis. I don't know where, you should have him come speak. The argument that Paul and I will have is Paul will say, in the end, it is all the same. There is one ultimate. Mm-hmm. And these are all different descriptions of the one ultimate. And I say, you are colonizing the ultimate with your Catholic understanding of what the ultimate is. Mm-hmm. That your description of an ultimate informed by Buddhism looks an awful lot like what your Catholic tradition would mm-hmm. describe as the ultimate. And I'm not willing to do that. I want to say there might be multiple ultimates. And Paul says, but if you accept that, then in the end, we don't have anything we can connect over. And I don't go there with him.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I appreciate the critique, because what you're pointing to, I think, is an appropriation of doctrine that had a purpose and an intention, and appropriating it to use for something it was never intended for, which is a legitimate method, but not a very responsible one if you're doing comparative work. Because if I collapse interbeing into mystery, then I have done what I've accused Paul Nitter of doing, right? And it's not very careful. At the same time, I can't defend Paul, but what I understand he's doing with that is trying to make a correlation between the Buddhist doctrine of interbeing, and he comes out of a Tibetan tradition, so he's already got a particular take on that, and the Christian doctrine of the Holy Spirit. And he wants to say, if I can't accept that the Holy Spirit is a person or a being, how do I understand how the Holy Spirit works? Well, gosh, it works an awful lot like Paticca-samuppada. That's useful for him in the project he's doing, but it doesn't seem to me very respectful of our Buddhist friends, because we're taking a doctrine and using it to rationalize something we don't like about our own tradition without honoring the richness of that doctrine in its original settings. Yeah? And so I hear you saying, Bidwell, you did that too.
It felt to me like you did that.
Okay. And I might have, yeah. I'll look.
I mean, I think the stories and the practices of people who do multiple.
I'm kind of in awe of it because it's not where my mind goes. My mind is much more singular. But I loved when Nils Hyman was here a couple of weeks ago, who's been a Buddhist monk, who's one of the teachers in the Dharma Leaders Group. He was raised Catholic and Liberation Catholic. He said, you know, I've gone back to a lot of the Catholic things. I just love the Blessed Virgin. So now I have my Catholic Buddhist. And it was so inspiring to me in the way he was so easy in embracing it and gave people a lot of permission to do that. So I appreciate the stories and the validation, and my concern is about collapsing distinctions that are real distinctions.
Yes. Yeah, and that is one of my concerns too, because if a Buddhist doesn't recognize the doctrine of interbeing in the way Paul Nitter talks about it, then it's not the doctrine of interbeing. It's something else.
And in the Theravadin tradition, we don't talk about interbeing.
True.
It's pretty much something you find in Thich Nhat Hanh and some Tibetan traditions. But, you know, we talk about codependent arising, which is in a very different sort of way, I think.
Yeah. Yes. You know, I'm not going to go there. Okay.
We have just a few minutes.
And we need 3 minutes for announcements.
Then we just have 1 minute.
So, as a practicing Christian and Buddhist, I think fundamentally I've always wondered how do you, one seems relational and one seems, I don't want to call Buddhism non-relational, but it's not relational. And it's either paradoxical, but that's a lot of what I think about. Like Jesus is so relational, he's so in the world. And then Buddhism is like this amazing way to kind of have equanimity. I'll stop talking, but that's a question.
Was there a question in that? No.
Was there a question there? That's just a question I have. Like,
yeah. And that's part of the challenge of bringing the traditions together, is the Semitic, Middle Eastern, from our perspective, Middle Eastern, tradition of a personal God, and the Buddhist tradition of maybe there's a God, maybe there's not. Knowing the answer doesn't help you get enlightened, so why bother, right? And the meaningful relationship some people have with a personal divinity and its absence in Buddhism, but also what some Buddhists would see as the delusion of a personal relationship with God. Yeah? So I haven't found a way to reconcile those yet. When I need God with skin on or God with a face, Christianity is great. Buddhism doesn't give it to me quite that way. But I also think there are developmental stages in our spiritual lives. And at some point, the personal becomes much less important, and paradox becomes paramount. Right? And at that point, the struggle between those things begins to evaporate. So I guess that's a way of saying, just wait.
They seem like they need each other to me.
Yeah.
But I feel like I need both of them.
Yes,
but they seem
too.
Incomplete.
I do too.
That's my experience, is they seem incomplete.
I do too. And my caveat here is we're talking like Buddhism is monumental, right? Now, there are lots of different Buddhisms. So there are schools of Buddhism that would see the Dharma as having personal aspects and acting on our behalf and looking out for us, right? So in some ways, we're making artificial distinctions, or we're not honoring the difference even within the traditions. So.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.